In for Dave Ross, I'm Aaron Granillo. A new diversion program for first-time felony offenders in King County puts taxpayers on the hook for victim restitution. Cover Radio's Hannah Scott reports.
For King County Prosecutor Dan Satterberg, it just makes sense.
Our 2021 budget is dependent upon us diverting cases into the community. It's something that the community leaders have wanted for a long time. And frankly, it's something that I have wanted as the prosecutor, because I know that the community nonprofits that are willing to work with young people who are involved with the justice system, they have some powers of persuasion that the typical court process does not.
He's talking about the restorative justice program just approved in the county budget that not only gives first-time low-level felony offenders a one-time shot at a do-over, it also pulls from taxpayer-funded county coffers to make their victims whole again. Here's how it works.
The county council has set aside a significant amount of money to pay community nonprofits to work with people. In the adult court, it will be people who are facing their first felony conviction. And then in juvenile court, it will be to take more of the young people out of the courtroom and into the community.
And Satterberg says it's something they already know works, given their work with young people in the prosecutor's office.
We have now for the last 9 years been diverting cases to a group like Choose 180 is our primary community nonprofit. Those are typically misdemeanor cases, but we are looking to put low-level felony cases into the community as well, as a way to meet the desire expressed by community leaders, but also to really help our court system through this time where we're going to have a tremendous backlog of cases coming out of COVID.
But he stresses they will tightly monitor outcomes here to ensure the adult program has the desired effect.
We will evaluate it. We'll evaluate the results that the community gets versus the results that the court process gets.
What he does know.
The county is leaning into it hard. We heard community members throughout the summer, and part of the comments during the civil rights protests of this summer was that the community wanted to be more involved in holding their own young people accountable for misbehavior, and the community thinks that they have some skills that the court process doesn't possess in order to turn someone's life around. So I'm happy to be sharing my power as the prosecutor with community nonprofits that want to work with justice-involved youth.
And Satterberg stresses these are lower-level felonies.
The cases that we're talking about in the adult diversion program are all the lowest-level property crimes, non-violent, non-domestic violence cases, theft, perhaps, or even a car theft or a broken window or something where the costs are at a felony level. Those are the kinds of cases that rather than putting into court, we're going to put into the community and really, I think, meet that desire for more community accountability, more role for the community in our work, particularly for people who are right on the cliff. You know, you fall off, you get your first felony. It just seems so easy to get that second and third one after that.
For offenders who do get the opportunity, this is a one-shot deal.
This is literally a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for somebody facing their first felony charge to instead work with and make a connection with a community nonprofit, with credible messengers and coaches and mentors in that community of nonprofit who will be paid by the county to do this work. So if they screw up and they come back, well, then they've had their one chance.
So the hope is that they take this opportunity for a second chance and run with it. And there will be accountability.
They will have the opportunity to develop their own accountability program that may be well different from what happens in a courtroom.
Many of the community groups that do this kind of work, like Community Passageways, Choose 180, and many others, are helmed by those with lived experience that Satterberg says can make all the difference in messaging with these offenders.
Maybe they've been in prison. Maybe they made bad choices as a youth. Now that they're an adult and they've changed their ways, they've changed their outlook on life, they have more of an ability to persuade an individual to change their path than walking into a courtroom and seeing a judge that doesn't have your lived experience, didn't come from your neighborhood or with your degree of chaos in your life. Somebody who has credibility in the eyes of a young person who's involved in the criminal justice system.
Bottom line is,
we think, and the evidence shows, that making that connection with somebody who cares about them and who will help them achieve more in their life, that's a very effective intervention strategy. It's a crime prevention strategy.
The county budget provides funding for the nonprofit groups that will eventually be chosen to lead this effort. It also includes between $90,000 and $150,000 for the restitution aspect.
The truth is that under the court system, we ask victims to wait a year, maybe 2 years, and after the COVID backlog, it may be longer than that, in hopes that once we get a conviction and a sentence of this individual, that they'll get their $500 ordered to be paid. But often, and we know this to be true, that victims don't get paid.
Satterberg says whatever the cost to cover victim restitution, something that had been the lone barrier to a program like this, it will be a drop in the bucket to the cost of processing somebody through the regular criminal justice system.
That is Cairo Radio's Hannes Scott. Driving along Denny Way yesterday on the way home from work, I saw it, the pink elephant in all of its glory, natural habitat. Our resident historian Felix Bunnell was there too. He was there when the vintage neon landmark was taken down from its perch. Felix, brought to us by the King County Library System.
Hey, was that you who drove by and shouted something out your window? Was it something like,
you heard
I love
that?
Cairo Radio? I wasn't sure what you were actually saying. I thought it was something positive. I couldn't actually tell.
It was, hey, Felix, what's going on?
Hey, good morning. Yeah, that was a big day for an iconic piece of roadside architecture. Perhaps the end of an era, maybe? I don't know. This is the Elephant Car Wash sign down at 7th Avenue and Denny Way. It stood at that spot for nearly 65 years. It was taken down yesterday by a crew from a local company called Western Neon. And I've known the Western Neon guys for almost 20 years. They've touched pretty much every iconic neon sign in the city. Now, I was talking to Andre Lucero from Western Neon on Monday night about the Holiday Star downtown. That's sort of a whole nother story. His company helped reimagine the old star, and they installed the new one last week. We were talking about that, and he mentioned that the elephant was coming down, kind of offhandedly, Tuesday morning. So it was going to come down at 9 o'clock yesterday, so they'd already taken off most of the neon and done some other preliminary work, so I decided to head down there myself. I got there about 8 o'clock and took a bunch of pictures, which we have at My Northwest, which I put on Twitter. I got a good spot on the sidewalk and thought I'd be there for maybe a half hour or so watching them take the elephant sign down. Now, one thing, that area has changed a ton in the last couple weeks, or maybe 10 days ago. They actually tore down the rest of the car wash, so it's just a vacant lot now. It looks very different. So Western Neon had a truck with a cherry picker on it. There were two guys up there working on the sign. They were reaching into the elephant through all these little access panels, and what they were doing, or what they were trying to do, was take off a series of bolts. And I only learned this from Andre on Monday night. The elephant's actually constructed in two halves, an upper half and a lower half. They had a harness attached to the top, which is connected to this very, very tall mobile crane. And, you know, shouldn't be any big surprise. All these signs were installed this way in the first place. So they're built with hooks on top. So it's very easy to move them. It's not unusual at all. So 9 a.m. came and went, and still the Western Neon guys were up there on the cherry picker with their arms inside the elephant, kind of reaching inside. About 9:30 or so, Andre came down and told me that the problem was the old bolts. You know, this thing was put together in 1956. They weren't stainless steel. They were these old, probably galvanized bolts were all rusted. And so they had to actually cut a bunch of them rather than actually unbolt them. And I think they ended up finding more bolts than they thought were there. And so they had to actually manually rotate the sign to get better access to those. Now, by this time, it's getting close to 10 o'clock. The TV stations were there. Seattle Times was there. And Western Neon came and told us that the top half of the elephant wouldn't be removed until about 2 o'clock. Mm. And, you know, it's raining and it's cold. And I'd never been to one of these in person, but it kind of felt like a NASA launch. Yeah. You know, the media's all there, and there's starting to all these sort of built-in holds and delays. Mm-hmm. And so I went home and had lunch and charged up my phone. So I came back at 1:30 and took more pictures, and sure enough, about 2 o'clock, they lifted the top half up. It was very exciting. This is the part that has the elephant's head on it and the big letters, or, you know, car, the top half of the car wash part. Mm-hmm. One thing, it was pretty windy, and it hadn't been at 9 o'clock. It was pretty calm, but by the time 2 o'clock rolled around, that wind was gusting a lot, and I've seen that sign in the past when it was just sitting there, the wind kind of rotated. But they had a rope on each end, and there was a guy at each end of the rope kind of guiding it. It looked like not quite the Hindenburg, that'd be the wrong thing, but it was sort of like a dirigible landing. They lifted it up really high, moved it over to the parking lot, and they gently lowered it down onto a little trailer that was hitched to the back of a pickup truck. It's weird when you see a sign like that down at ground level when you've only seen it up on a post for a long time. It sometimes looks smaller than you think it was going to be, or sometimes larger. And when it was being lifted, it looked smaller. But then on the ground, it looked bigger. It was kind of a weird optical illusion thing. But they put it on this trailer, and about 25 minutes later, they lifted the bottom half up. And the bottom half was on a really long pole. Like, they kept lifting it and lifting it, and this big, rusty, I don't know, probably 12-inch diameter pipe that the thing is on. Just it kept coming and coming and coming, and finally that popped up in the air, and they lowered that onto the ground. Now, it was weird. There was never a big crowd on hand. It was sort of, part of it is, I guess, that location. You know, driving by there, it's kind of a bit of a freeway. Denny's a very busy street.
You sound disappointed in that, Felix.
Yeah, I've been wrestling with this. And I'll say at no point during the whole maneuver yesterday did I get a lump in my throat or feel that sort of emotional thing that I felt at other similar occasions. This isn't my first, you know, neon removal rodeo by any stretch
of
imagination.
Of course not.
But I never did feel that emotional. This all felt very much kind of a, I don't know, sort of a grim task or something. But when they did haul it away on the first half, they hauled it away on a pickup truck trailer. There were a big crowd, maybe three people, all pointing their cell phones. I don't think I heard any clapping or cheering. Some of those cars driving by were honking their horns. But, you know, it's just sort of a, it's, I have mixed emotions about it because, you know, it's not going to the dump. It's going to this Western Neon shop. Mm-hmm. They're going to restore it. It's going to ultimately end up at the Museum of History and Industry, which is over on, you know, Lake Union Park. And that's fine. It will be preserved. But I still feel like these neon signs should be preserved in the place where we've seen them for, 64 years. It's not quite Mount Rainier or the Olympic Mountains, but it is part of the visual landscape. And you grow accustomed to it, and people give directions based on it. And it kind of gives this, a specific identity for a part of the city that's different from any other part of the city and different from other cities around the country or around the world. So that one of the things I discovered in this whole process is that there was no permit required to take that sign down. Mm. There was a permit for demolishing the car wash, which makes sense. But Seattle Department of Construction Inspections told me that, you know, they have a very rigorous process for putting a sign up. They have sort of laws that apply to, you know, what you can and can't display. But when it comes time to take it down, you can just take it down. You know, unless the sign has been landmarked, and there's only one landmark sign in the city. Can you take a guess what the only landmark sign is? P.I. Globe.
Oh, very good. Yeah.
Which used to be across the street from the Elephant from 1948 to 1986. It was across the street. Anyway, so I feel like there's potential there to do some kind of changing of the regulations to address signs that haven't been landmarked, but that are part of the visual landscape like this. There should have been some kind of review process, I think. But who knows? But again, it will be saved. It will be inside. But it'll be sad to be driving down that, speeding on Denny Way with the rain coming down and the darkness and not see those super letters on one side and the car wash letters on the other side. So kind of mixed emotions, kind of bittersweet moment for an amazing visual icon. You know, I think about signs like the Bardol sign in Ballard. Mm-hmm. Like that's not a landmark, and that could be taken down probably anytime anybody wanted to. So I don't know. It's, you get into private property issues and property rights and that sort of thing, but there is some cultural value to these once sort of garish commercial advertisements that just become part of the city's soul. So
are there any,
I think there's some work to do.
Are there any other signs out there, do you think, that still hold some of that old school Seattle soul?
I think Bardol is one of them. Mm-hmm. The P.I. Globe is. The P.I. Globe needs a lot of help. It's just been sitting there. What should happen is the city, the Landmarks Board, should invest money in a survey where they just drive around and identify signs that fit some certain criteria as being part of the visual landscape that should be at least considered for landmark status. That would be the first step to do.
Very good. So, all right, Felix Bunnell, sorry you lost your pink elephant.
Thanks, Aaron.
All right. Seattle's Morning News, and for Dave Ross this morning, I am Aaron Granillo, and it seems now what doctors and nurses feared most is starting to happen. More hospitals in our state are filling up. State and local leaders are making a final plea for people not to gather over the holidays. But there is some hope on the horizon, too. Cover Radio's Hannah Scott is live with all of those details. Hannah.
Yeah, Aaron, well, some of the numbers that we've seen in just the last few days are really astronomical. They've, you know, we were averaging about 2,000 new cases a day. There was a backlog, and now just yesterday, nearly 3,600 new cases of COVID-19 were reported. And that's brought us up to over 151,000 cases statewide since the start of the pandemic. We're nearing the 2,700 mark for deaths. What's the most concerning, though, is the hospitalizations, as you mentioned. Governor Inslee detailing the latest on the situation yesterday.
Right now, this activity is so high. Our statewide rate of COVID-19 transmission is 300 people per 100,000. We've had more than 6,000 cases that have been reported just in the last 3 days. We have almost a vertical curve on how fast this pandemic is moving upwards. It is really quite stunning and certainly alarming to all of us who understand what the future could hold if we do not act aggressively against this pandemic.
So for now, we've got the restrictions that he put in place a little over a week ago, which he says are very targeted. But he warns we could see more restrictions if this doesn't turn around.
We are hopeful that that more targeted approach can bend that curve down. But if it does not, we will have no other option but to extend those restrictions to other parts of our economy. There will be no other option available to us.
A state medical association president, Dr. Nathan Schlicker, is also an ER doctor. He had this offer.
The indoor aspect, and when we take our masks off to eat and drink in confined spaces, we've seen that those outbreaks in the healthcare setting as well. It's not just the restaurant setting, because the reality is the virus doesn't take time off for us to eat. It exploits our weaknesses and the moments when we're not masked up. And I grieve for everyone that's losing their job. We need to support our small businesses. If you can still pay your gym membership, even though you're not going, do it. If you can go take takeout, please do. We all need to rally together to help keep everybody in their employment and in their line of work as whole as we can.
And he says he needs everyone to rally together to support the health workers at the same time, because they are starting to be overwhelmed. Some of them are being sick. His hospital, where he works down in the south part of Pierce County, is already nearing capacity. Several others, as the governor explained yesterday, are at or above capacity. Nearly all of the hospitals in the state are starting to limit surgeries and things like that. And that's going to be a big problem as we move forward. They really, really stressed yesterday that they need to have everybody listen and follow the guidance as far as the Thanksgiving get-togethers go, because it's too dangerous. Dr. Schlicker says,
and taking it seriously like we do helmets and seatbelts is so critically important, because if we're going to respect the sacrifice that so many Americans and so many Washingtonians are making in this battle by being apart, by caring for each other, by keeping our distance, then we need to do what we can in our daily lives. And that means wearing a mask and not getting overly excited that just because a vaccine is on the horizon, it doesn't mean that we can ignore all of the public health measures today.
Now, Snohomish County Medical Officer Dr. Chris Spittard says yesterday there's some good news.
We anticipate that one or more vaccine manufacturers will apply to the Food and Drug Administration for emergency use authorization for one or more vaccines in the coming weeks. If the FDA and then subsequently CDC's review of the data concur that these are safe and effective vaccines appropriate for use, we could begin to see the first doses of COVID vaccine shipped to our area within mid to late December.
So that's good news. And he said what would first happen, and we heard the same from the governor yesterday, is that the healthcare workers, first responders, folks like that, would get the initial doses of this vaccine. After that, long-term care facilities, some of the more vulnerable at-risk populations. But what Dr. Spittard stressed yesterday is it's going to be months before this is available widely for everyone in the state. And that's where we need to get to in order to stop having to follow all of this guidance. So given the surge that we're seeing in cases right now, with death rates are expected to start to go up here in the next 2 to 3 weeks as well, and we are seeing some already go up, he says it's so important that everybody follows this guidance. And unfortunately, Dr. Spittard says, what we're seeing as far as travel right now is a problem.
A surge in travel suggests that many people have plans to gather with people outside their household this coming Thanksgiving. But if more people don't cancel those plans this week, some of those guests or their loved ones or coworkers will become ill, some severely. This will worsen the existing hospital surge that will compromise care, not just for COVID patients.
So, Hannah, I'm looking right now at the IHME, the health metric evaluation from the University of Washington. Right now it's showing that ICU beds, if the models hold true, that we will hit capacity by right around January 1st. Is that what the state seems to suggest too?
Yes, and that's definitely what I heard yesterday, is that beginning of January is going to be when that is expected to happen if we don't see some sort of change. And actually, some of the numbers that we're already seeing are baked in because of the lag, right? You've got the number. We know what we've seen, given the number of cases we've seen every day and how that's translated into hospitalizations a couple, 2-3 weeks later, and that will translate into deaths as well. So they expect in the next 1-3 weeks, we'll see an increase in deaths, more need for those ICU beds. And once we get to those ICU beds, when those become overwhelmed, it's so bad because then you have to start making very, very difficult decisions as between life and death. Who gets to live? Who gets to die?
And you're saying that's, and the state is saying this, of course, too, that it's not just the fact that we need hospital beds for COVID patients. It's for everybody. Yes.
Yes, absolutely. And so that's the other thing. We heard that, you know, there are so many people who have had other conditions and have gotten, long-term health problems because they couldn't get hospital beds the first time around, various things like that. Whether you need a hip surgery, all kinds of things that can affect your health. It's dangerous for everyone. And that's the thing that you hear from the governor, every one of our health officials in the state. They try to get everyone to understand that if you're not seeing this yourself impact your daily life, if you're not, you don't know anyone who's sick, you don't know anyone who's died, something like that, understand that this will have wide-ranging effects to everyone in the community, not just those who get COVID, not just those who test positive and maybe have mild symptoms. There's so much that goes into this that will have very long-term effects. And it is really, really hard at this point on those healthcare workers. That's why you keep seeing them coming out and really pleading with all of us to not be selfish and follow the guidance.
And as for the vaccine, it sounds like at least the first batch could be distributed by early next year, potentially.
Yeah. Well, for mid-December is when they said they'd have it in Snohomish County, that, again, they'd give it to the first responders, healthcare workers on the front lines, things like that. But, yeah, then in the more high-risk populations. But, again, we have to stress, for all of us, for everybody to get it, it's not going to be for maybe spring, maybe fall next year. So there's several months that we need to follow the guidance is what I heard across the board yesterday.
All right. Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott. Thank you.
You bet.
Let's get to your daily dose of kindness now. It's sponsored by Mike Novak and ListWithNovak.com. Are you struggling to come up with what you're thankful for this year? CBS correspondent Steve Hartman is here to help.
With the pandemic raging, schools closed, and our democracy in limbo, a holiday about gratitude may feel a little off.
What can we possibly be thankful for in 2020?
When I posed that question to my kids, I got crickets.
Well, instead of saying what we're thankful for, we could say what was hard for us.
We definitely could. But before giving up on Thanksgiving completely, I had a hunch that hope for this holiday might lie here at People's Place, a thrift store and food pantry in Kingston, New York. Like most food pantries in America, People's Place has seen a huge increase in need.
Right now, I'm definitely struggling.
I lost my job. It's been rough for everybody, you know.
And yet, if you ask folks here if they have anything to be grateful for this Thanksgiving, you'll get a surprising wealth of words.
I'm grateful. Be alive and breathing on your own is the best.
My arms work. My legs work. I can walk.
I'm not living out on the streets. I have a roof over my head.
I'm grateful that we still have what we have.
I'm grateful for being alive.
This is Gabriel, like the angel. Wouldn't give me a last name. Just a revelation.
Pay close attention to what this guy has to say and how he's going to spend his Thanksgiving.
I'm going to have an amazing Thanksgiving all by myself. I will sit on the park bench, and I will think about the great Thanksgivings that I've had in my life and be thankful for them. One bad Thanksgiving out of 63 amazing Thanksgivings, that's pretty good odds. Maybe we should be a little more thankful for what we do have than constantly be complaining about what we don't have.
What do you think?
Yeah, I think he's right.
I think he's really right.
Some people have lost so much, yet so many I spoke to kept at least an attitude of gratitude, as if thankfulness was sustenance.
If these people just found something to be thankful for, I mean, it seems like there's no way not to.
Revelation received. Mm-hmm. Steve Hartman, on the road in Kingston, New York.
And there you go.
What are you thankful for this year, Colleen?
I'm thankful to have a job and work for a company that has allowed me to put my family first, mm-hmm. because this pandemic has forced me to make them my number one priority.
Very good.
And now from the G and Ursula Show, weekdays 9 to noon here on Cairo Radio, it is G Scott. G, I heard you talking with Ursula the other day about a vaccine for COVID-19. You were hesitant at first to roll up your sleeves and get one. Now you're all in, yes?
You know, it just depends on what day you ask me. Okay. You know what I mean? Like, I was not good one day. I was good the next day. Let's see. Right now, it's Wednesday. It's Thanksgiving Eve. I'm not all that happy about it right now. But tomorrow, I might be good. Here's what the thing. You start reading up on what they're talking about with this. And they're saying, both of them, Moderna and Pfizer, they're both saying that it will require two doses, yep. right? Yep. And one of the things that the CDC has talked about, and they're being transparent about it, and one of them are talking about, they're talking about some of the side effects. Like, look, you look on TV all the time and you're sitting there, you might not be paying attention to the commercial, but all of a sudden you pay attention to the side effects. So you ever notice they go real fast on the side effects?
Indeed.
They go so fast, so they're like, hey, it's no big deal, but we got to cover our bases.
But well, how often have you taken a medication that had, Advil, over-the-counter stuff has side effects, and how often have you experienced that?
Never with any Advil or Excedrin or
yeah,
or,
I mean, no, they have no, to list like the side effects, but the chances of you having that side effect, you have to look at the fine print.
Now, how about the flu shot? Have you ever felt the side effects of a flu shot? I think some people listening will say, yeah, I felt it. Whether
the
you had
immune
a sore
response?
Yeah.
Be glad your immune system is working. That's what I say.
I mean, Kali, we can go back and forth on this all day. I
acknowledge that people are uncomfortable about a new vaccine. I just get squeamish at any conversation around being skeptical of one or scared of one, because look at the damage that was done over the measles vaccine and the flu shot when people don't get it because they don't think they need it because it's just the flu. Like, I just, that's why I'm a bit squeamish and I'm pushing back. Vaccines are necessary.
How dare someone have doubt about a vaccine, Colleen? I mean,
I'm not saying how dare. I acknowledge your discomfort. I acknowledge that some might be scared, mm-hmm. but I'm uncomfortable with the conversation from professionals who have knowledge at their fingertips and can talk to the doctors behind this. You talk to a virologist every week.
Absolutely.
We need to be spreading information that is helpful, not putting doubt into people's minds about a vaccine that's going to stop a global pandemic.
Okay, but real quick, I'm going to talk truth about it as well. And the truth is there is still an unknown. The truth is there's still a possibility of a side effect. Now, you can have an opinion. So when Aaron Grinnello asked me my opinion, I said, yeah, you know, one day I'm good, one day I'm not. But the truth of the matter is there's going to possibly be a vaccine. And I think all of us wish that and hope that it is going to be good for us. But there's still going to be information that's going to be needed. There's going to still possibly be side effects. We don't truly know what those are until they're laid out. And so, again, like, I don't know whether you're comfortable or not comfortable with a conversation, it's a real conversation. There are some that are skeptical of it, and there are some that are not. We have to, my job, at least mine, is to put out my truth in an opinion. Now, yes, I do talk to a virologist every single day, and we've discussed this conversation right here and the potential of there being side effects and what there are. Some of them right now are talking about headaches. They're talking about chills. They're talking about them lasting for 24 hours and how some of them have told some of the respondents to it to maybe take a day off before getting the second dosage. So, yes, it's still a conversation.
And, gee, you're not alone. I mean, the polls throughout this pandemic show, 40-60% of people might be skeptical and whatnot. But what would it convince you to feel like it is safe? What do you need?
I mean, let me see Barry go ahead and take it. That's a Barack Obama. Hey, Barry, okay. You took it? All right, man, I'm good, man. I'm going to go ahead and jump in line when you take it. I think like anything, right? I think once it starts to get out there, you start seeing the medical professionals start to get behind them and it starts happening. I think there's going to be a lot of people that want to get through this. Look, we want to get through this global pandemic, and I think we can all agree that the key to truly getting through this right here through COVID will be through vaccination. So at some point, it's going to have to get right in the first place.
G. Scott, here from 9 to noon. Thank you, G.
All right.
Seattle's Morning News, and for Dave Ross, I'm Aaron Grinnello. We will hear Dave in just a few seconds, though, because yesterday's press conference from Governor Inslee was about bending the COVID curve back down here in Washington. So Dave, who is technically on vacation but always up for a chat with the governor, spoke with Inslee just after he wrapped up.
Some critics have made a distinction between the number of cases and actual hospitalizations, using the number of cases makes things sound worse than they are. Although I'm looking at the University of Washington curve, and they're predicting that, by January, we will be out of ICU beds. Anyway.
Well, listen, let's be clear about this. That is ridiculous, because our hospitalizations are at or exceeding what they were in March when we were building pop-up hospitals. And so the hospitalizations now are at an all-time high during this pandemic and will exceed it dramatically. This thing has been doubling every 10 days or so. So the hospitalization numbers are in a very, very concerning spot. We do have hospitals already that are having to start curtailing their elective procedures. But just looking ahead, this is, you know, if you're going to beat this pandemic, you have to get ahead of the curve. If you're behind it, it just kills you. So we have to look where we'll be in 2 to 3 weeks. And in 2 or 3 weeks, unless these trends continue, we will be in a situation where there is massive loss of normal medical support for elective surgeries and the like. And at some point, you get to a position where you're in crisis care, standards of care, and that means people just don't get life-saving treatment.
Has nothing worked? Any of the procedures that restaurants and these other businesses have taken in the days since we first hit the peak in April, none of that was enough?
Well, no, we do believe that we tamped down what I'd call the second wave this past summer by adopting wide-scale mask usage, and we were leading the curve, one of the leading states on this, and that's why we actually bent the curve down a second time in the second wave, and that was because of the diligence of Washingtonians who put on masks, and that was very, very successful. Other states did not do that, and that is a significant reason why their rates are sometimes 10 times higher than ours. So we did have success this summer with a combination of good hygiene in our stores, thanks to good business owners and employees, and people putting on masks when they go shopping. And that did allow us to keep these numbers low. But as winter has come on, and as we've gone on inside, and as the rest of the nation has seen these explosive rates that eventually come into our state, we've just been hammered. Now, I do want to put this in perspective. Troublesome as it is, there are 45 other states that today have higher disease rates than we do. And so we have had considerable success, and it is because of Washingtonians' responsibility. You just noticed today that there was a study done that showed when it comes to being safe on Thanksgiving, we're the number one state in the United States. So, I mean, we are doing things relatively right, but we have to up our game.
So providing relief, it looks like Congress is not going to do it, at least not until after the inauguration. You've pried loose some additional money. Does the state have enough money to keep some of these restaurants? I mean, you're hearing more and more businesses saying, and I get the emails, that this is it for us. We came pretty close to extinction the first time, but now we have to throw in the towel.
Well, at the moment, we're getting close to the end of the account we have of the CARES funding. There's about $150 million left. So we do have some cash that could be available, but we have a lot of other claims to that. We are going to need to hire some more contact tracers. We need more work on our vaccine distribution system. Hospitals need some, potentially are asking for financial assistance. And the reason is they become full, they have to cancel their elective surgeries, which were one of their sort of profit centers or revenue centers. So there are many, many claims to this remaining $150 million. So this is something we will continue to look at. We are talking to legislators of both parties about their ideas about potential further relief for not just restaurants, but other small businesses as well. And so those things are under consideration. We all are still hopeful for some congressional action, as you know, because that's really where the real flexibility exists to do big things, multi-billion dollar things. I do want to reiterate as well, though, while we are looking for help for the owners of the businesses, in my book, we got to think about the employees with equal respect, and their unemployment, many of them are going to lose unemployment at the end of this year, and I believe that we need to look at a solution for them. Now, what that is we've got to figure out how to finance it, and money doesn't grow on trees, and as you know, we have a multi-billion dollar hole in our budget already. So people said we got this rainy day fund, but the rainy day fund is already allocated just to try to plug this multi-billion dollar hole we have in our budget. That hole is not as big as it was 2 months ago because our economy continues actually to be, in some sense, healthy, generate these revenues. But it's still multiple billions of dollars. So if we do this, we'll have to figure out a way to finance it, and that's not going to be easy. And I will continue to talk to legislators of both parties about how to do that.
I'll bet you have some ideas, though. And would one of them be some sort of income tax?
No.
No.
No. That's an easy one.
You're very quick to say no.
Because it's an honest answer.
Is that whole idea dead now? I know. Is that whole idea dead now?
There's no serious discussion of an income tax that in the legislature that I'm aware of.
Wealth tax. Any other tax? Any other tax that people would find annoying?
Well, I've kind of find all taxes are annoying to somebody, so I wouldn't say they're all annoying to some degree. Listen, there's a million different ideas that we probably wouldn't be productive to talk about, but we will make proposals in mid-December when I roll out my budget. We will propose a balanced budget. It'll do the best job it can to help businesses and employees and health systems and hospitals and the mental health and our homelessness program. And we'll have all the answers revealed in mid-December when we roll out our budget. And I'll be happy to talk to you then about these things.
Okay. I've got just two other questions for you. Are you expecting a call from Lauren Culp? And are you expecting a call from the Biden administration?
I have no expectations for my former opponent. And I have no expectations for the Biden administration. But I think they're off to a great start. I'm very pleased this nomination of John Kerry to really show that we're back in the climate effort internationally is a really healthy thing, both because he's very well respected around the world. And I think it's a signal of how what a top priority President-elect Biden is going to give to this issue. So I'm very pleased about that.
Governor Jay Inslee, Governor, thank you.
Thank you. Be well.
Governor Inslee with Dave Ross. And you can hear an extended version of that interview on the COVID-19 Seattle podcast hosted by myself and Dave. I asked Dave a few questions about what he thought about Inslee's answers as they pertain to the possibility of a tax, for instance, and all of these restrictions that we are in the middle of. You can just text COVID to 98973 to subscribe to that podcast.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.